Things are getting more tense. It's like Jesus is tearing the world in two. He's dividing the world between the sheep and the goats. There are those who follow him. There's those who are increasingly hostile to him. Those who love him more dearly. And those who hate him more earnestly. And it's like the whole world is being divided into two. Jesus said, I haven't come to bring peace. I've come to bring a sword. And in that sense, you can see him wielding that sword, can't you? And you can see it in the reading. I think there are people who are just getting more aggressive, more hostile. And then there's other people who are just beginning to twig and realize and listen and delight in who this person is and realize and start to appreciate this person for who he really is. And that's what we're dealing with this morning. That first couple of days, he's now arriving in Jerusalem. This is the second day he's in Jerusalem. And the first day he did that first visit, looked around the temple. He obviously didn't like what he saw. And he comes to the fig tree and he curses the fig tree. And it's a sort of an expression of his righteous indignation about what he's seen. And he goes into the temple. He starts turning over the tables, doesn't he? And then the following morning, the tree is dead. And you can see it's the beginning, it's the harbinger of something. It's a sign, isn't it, of something that's still to come. And he walks back into the temple, as we're reading today in chapter 11, verse 27, where we're beginning. He comes back into the temple to do some teaching. And he's the Lord in his rightful place. It's the house of the Lord. He is the Lord. He's amongst his people, where he should be praised and welcomed and loved and respected. And he's been, turning over the tables, he's been doing what the other people should have been doing. They should have been cleaning house. They should have made the place a place of prayer for all nations. But they just turned it into a place of self-interest. And he's been dealing with the issues that need to be dealt with. And you'd think that people would say, well, you know, fair play to him. He's actually doing what needs to be done. Let's get behind this. But no, anything but. As we see there in verse 27, they come out. They come out like a bunch of barking dogs, don't they? Who do you think you are, Jesus? By what power do you think you're doing what you're doing? What gives you the right? I don't know if you ever watched these watchdog programs, but I was astonished by something I saw on one of these watchdog programs. And they were doing an investigation into the trade in illegal meat, which I didn't really know much about, but people are smuggling meat into the country and selling it through the markets, inner city markets and so on. And they'd got one of these undercover teams and they were going in, they were filming this person's enterprises and his activities. It's unhealthy, it's dangerous, it's illegal, etc., etc. And eventually they do that thing where they stick the camera underneath the nose of the person, don't they? They catch up and say, this is the BBC and, you know, we've been filming over the last few days. And you'd think at a moment like that, that the guy would say, that was used to do, didn't you? It's a fair cop, gov. Right? That's what used to happen, right? Okay? You're on camera. You've been caught. The BBC, they've got the files. This guy got a billhook. And he started chasing the cameraman and wielding it around. You know, it was a common assault recorded by the BBC. You'd have thought at a point like that, he'd have actually backed off and realized the game was up. But no, he added common assault to his other crimes and, you know, it was all recorded and so on and so forth. You know, there's a time to realize that the game is up. And here, Jesus is in the temple. He has the people casting down their cloaks. He's fulfilling all the prophecies. The miracles are simply outstanding. And they come to him and say, who do you think you are? They are attacking Jesus. I don't know how you find people's attitudes concerning Jesus in this day and age. I don't know what you think their attitudes are, but I think people are very dismissive, aren't they? People can be very hostile. People can be very derisory and derogatory about Jesus, dismissive at best, and so on and so forth. And it's like they haven't realized that the game is up. The game is up. You know, when you're playing against somebody and they're holding all the cards, and yet you kind of fight on and you just stubbornly, proudly, you can't see. You've lost. Give up. The game is up. But so they fight on. They are fighting on. You know, Jesus has been very gracious towards these people because up for some time now he's been aware of their activities, and he's been pointing them out, and he's been speaking about them publicly, and he's been giving opportunity to correct. And you give people opportunity, don't you? That's the right way, don't you? You talk about the right way, and you expect people to sort of be aware of that. And then, having heard it, then if they don't comply, you sort of might sort of say, well, you know, a bit concerned about the way it's going, start to raise the stakes a little bit, and maybe come into some sort of a reproof. You know, look, this has got to stop. And that's how discipline happens, isn't it? It's an incremental thing. It happens gradually, fairly, honestly, openly, in the right spirit, and so on and so forth. And then you get to the point where you actually have to, that there's no compliance, and you have to start to administer some sanctions. You have to start doing something about it. Up until now, Jesus has been speaking about the activities of these people. He's been exposing the activities of the people, but he hasn't done anything yet. And for the first time, he's gone into the temple and he's turned over the tables, and now he's acting. Something is happening. Do you remember in the book of Exodus how when God sent Moses down to Egypt to come and deliver the people, he started by giving a word, "Set my people free." And that everything that needed to be known was in that statement. That's all that had to happen. But people dug their heels in, and they got proud and hard-hearted, and they tried to keep going and do it their own way. And gradually, the rivers turned to blood. Gradually, the little changes happened. The first plagues that God sent were quite mild. They didn't touch the people. They kind of maybe touched the livestock and so on. And the situation, it's like the temperature started to go up. Until eventually, they're losing their firstborn. And these people in the temple, they've been warned. We see this in politics at the moment, don't we? Where in the international community, you know, something's happened, some abuse of what is basically international law. And initially they say, look, you know, this is out of line, you can't carry on like this. And then further to that, there's some warnings and reproof, and then the sanctions start, you know, they start freezing your assets and you can't travel and all the rest of it. We're going through this all the time, it seems, in politics. Sanctions seems to be every day on the news. There seems to be something about sanctions, doesn't it? And then there's the point, the big debate, once you hit that point where sanctions don't seem to be working, are you going to follow this through? Are you going to take the ultimate steps? Are you going to shut this thing down? Are you going to cross the border? Are you going to cross the threshold? And there's been various experiments with that over the last decade or two, haven't they? And with greater or lesser extent of success, and people are nervous about it because there's a people on the other side who you're being imposing the sanctions on, and they're saying, they wouldn't dare. You wouldn't dare. We'll fight you. And you can get to a situation where you say, better the devil we know. Let's just, you know, don't tinker with it. Let's just leave it the way it is. And they can carry on doing the things they're doing, it seems, with impunity. But then something happens. Eventually something happens. You see it in the workplace, don't you? The person who just doesn't turn up for work, or they're late for work. Every single day they're late for work. And you're short-staffed and it's tough because you think, what can you do? But there they are. Better the devil you know. You know, when they're there, they're all right, but if they turn up, and then eventually there's the verbal warning, and then there's the written warning, and the second written warning with witnesses and all the rest of it, and they're thinking to themselves, they're never going to sack me. They, you know, I've been here too long. I know the ropes. And, you know, and eventually the day comes where, I'm sorry, mate, you're fired. And that's it. Often they sort of look shocked. You can't do that. They just did. It happens in family life, doesn't it? With boundaries, setting boundaries. Half of the trick of parenting is just that business of laying down consistent, fair boundaries for everybody's protection, interest, and so on and so forth, and administering them lovingly, consistently, carefully. You know, kids, they don't exploit those little loopholes because they're out to ruin the world. It's just nature. You know, it's just they're exploring. That's what they're doing. We have to be on top of that and ahead of it, and, you know, making sure it all works. I go to Wales, as you know, and when I go up to Wales, I see these great big fields, and they're full of grass. Full of delicious grass. They've got fences all the way around them. This is the place. This is where the grass is. This is where you eat. But all the sheep, there's always like this handful of sheep with their head through this one little hole. As if the grass out there on the road is the safe. That's the grass. That's the grass to eat. There's always two or three of them, like, stuck. You know, they've got a leg through like this, you know, trying to catch through this hole. And their job is to keep those boundaries well maintained, isn't it? For their safety. They've got everything they need in that safe place. And yet people are pushing up against the boundaries all the time, pushing up. And here in chapter 11, verse 27 to 43, they're just pushing against the boundary. They're talking to the king. Who do you think you are? They're talking to the king. They have no idea what they're doing, have they? They've completely lost sense of proportion, of reality. And they are completely consumed by this. I remember going into a church in Jerusalem some time ago, in the pool, what is the Pool of Siloam, just outside sort of the main center of the temple complex. And you go there, and there's a church there. I can't remember if it's Roman Catholic or Greek Orthodox now, but it's got a beautiful dome. And when you walk inside it, the dome has got a unique acoustic. You can stand underneath it and you can whisper. And that whisper just carries through the whole building. It is fantastic. It is a work of art. And I was with a group of Christians and we walked up. And you can stand on a certain spot. You have to join this queue. And you stand on a certain spot and then you whisper something and you can hear it go around the room. And it's all very nice. So somebody stood up there and went, "Amazing grace." And it just filled the place. It was so. And the next person, because you only get like 5-10 seconds, because there's this huge, great big queue behind you. The next person went, "How sweet the sound." It was just so lovely. The priests, they came out in their long black robes and their big black beard. What do you think? They threw us out of the church. They threw us out of the church. But because we were praising God in the house of the Lord. They're out of their tiny minds. What was that place for? What was it all built for? They've completely lost the plot, haven't they? It's so important, isn't it, as a human being, to know where you stand, to know who you are, to know who God is, to get that relationship right, and not allow ourselves to get exalted into a position which we're not comfortable in. It's not safe, it's not healthy, it's not good. It will destroy us if we try and put our place of God. And that's what Jesus is teaching them. In chapter 12, in that parable, they have been on a consistent road, a dangerous path for a very, very long time. And eventually, they will get themselves into an irreversible problem. They've been given so much grace, given so much time. They forget that the tenant does not own the property. They do not own the property. They get to live in the property. They have rights to enjoy and so on and so forth. But if you abuse that right, if you abuse those opportunities and those privileges for long enough, you will find yourself out on your ear. I've had the mixed experience with a couple of people renting our house over a long-term period up in Wales from time to time. We've had some interesting experiences, haven't we? One person said, I don't know if it's because they thought I was a Christian and therefore they could go for this one, but they said that God had spoken to them and said that he was to have a 7-year tenancy and that also he had to give up his job so he could spend more time reading the Bible and in prayer, and therefore he wasn't going to be paying the rent. He is no longer my tenant. Okay? And another person, they decided they just leave the door open when they went out all the time. They left their clothes strewn all over the place. This is a grown man, collected Lego. And in the end, the place was getting so damp that there was a mold growing up around. So I wrote him a letter, said, could you please, you know. He took a hammer and smashed up all the furniture and threw it out and just left it strewn all over the place. Do you think he's still my tenant? There's some great people out there. There are some great people out there. Thank God. Thank God. Right? Okay? But there's whole programs about it, isn't it? The tenants from hell. And after a while, something has to be done. And it's an awful place to put yourself in because you want a good relationship. You want a good situation. You want to give as much time as you can. Best possible circumstances. Work your way through all the issues and all the rest of it. But in the end, it catches up. You see, Genesis chapter 12. In Genesis chapter 12, we read about how God spoke to Abraham. And he gave him amazing and wonderful promises. Of a people that would be great and a nation and a blessing to the whole world. And in verse 7, chapter 12, verse 7, he said, as he entered into the land of Canaan, he said, To your seed, I will give this land. To your seed. Now, in Galatians, the Apostle Paul comments on that verse, and he points out that that word seed, offspring, child, is the masculine singular. In other words, one man. I will give it to one of your sons, just one. And then Paul makes the point, who is the seed of Abraham? Who is the son of Abraham? It is Jesus Christ, the Messiah. Jesus has come for his inheritance. He has come home. He's come to his land. He's come to his house. He's come to his city. It belongs to him. Matthew chapter 1 verse 1 says, Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, the son of Abraham. Everything they're enjoying, everything they have, belongs to him by rights, gifted by God. And yet they come to him and say, who do you think you are? Who do they think they are? Isn't that the question? They just didn't like what they heard. And just like paying their rent, as we see in chapter 12, verses 13 through 17, you know, we do have to pay our rent, we have to pay our due, we have to pay our taxes. We're talking about, you know, legitimate costs for services, for things that we enjoy and benefit from. And they've been given so much. And when it comes to taxes, it's like people who don't want to pay their rent, these people don't want to pay their taxes. Now, nobody, humanly speaking, you know, maybe you don't actually like parting with the money. I do understand on that human level. But it doesn't belong to you. And we pay our taxes. We give it up, don't we? Because it doesn't actually belong to us. If we hang on to it and we try to cheat the government or we do all those sort of things, we are committing a crime. It's a crime. And eventually, oh, wasn't that awful poster in Trowbridge? Do you see that big poster in Trowbridge looking out for benefit fraudsters? It was like this pair of eyes looking through a hole in the wall, like, we're out to get you, we're going to see you, we're going to catch you. But eventually, it catches up with us. It catches up with us. And he talks about taxes, doesn't he? What do you think is going to happen if you don't pay your taxes to Caesar? This is Augustus Caesar. Do you think he's going to be take it lying down, right? Okay, eventually, these people, this same group of people who's being addressed here, they, in about 30 years after this event, decided they were going to stop paying their taxes to Caesar as a nation. They decided to throw off the protection and the responsibilities that they had, and they were going to go it alone, and they stopped paying their taxes to Caesar. And Caesar sent two crack legions into Judea, and he flattened that city and that place. He plowed it into the earth. He destroyed the place. You have to pay your taxes, or you pay the price. And I wonder what it is that makes people think, okay, I'm going to go to the restaurant. Do you pay when you go to a restaurant? It's nice to have a voucher, but generally speaking, you pay. If you go to the cinema, you pay. You go to the shops and you get some food. You pay. Or like these guys. If you know these guys are getting these trolleys, they're filling it up with meat, and then they're running out of the supermarket, nicking all the meat and stuff like that. You heard about that recently? But if you get caught, you will pay. In the end, we have to pay. Why won't we give God what belongs to him? Why won't we just give God what belongs to him? What does he want from us? What does he want? What does God want from us? Or are we going to spend the whole of our lives exploiting the loopholes, finding our way around, ducking and diving, going beneath the radar, being smart, tricking traps, all the rest of it, as these people are so evidently trying to do? There's a big thing about tax avoidance at the moment, isn't there? It's a scandal. Fiddling our expenses. Why can't we just give to God what belongs to him? Give to God what belongs to him. What does God own? The Bible says, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. If you have something good, anything good, it belongs to God. It's a gift from God. You have it like a tenant, on trust, on charge. It's a privilege. It's a blessing to be able to be enjoyed. And what does he want from us in return? Does God want your money? Do you think God's after your money? Do you think that's what it is? He's just trying to hit your wallet. How about just some faith? How about just some thanks? How about an acknowledgement? How about some appreciation? Some recognition that his name is not a name to just be cast into the dirt, to be dismissed as if he doesn't exist, as if he's not here, as if it doesn't matter, he doesn't care. How about the praise that's due to his name? How about the thanks for all the good things that we enjoy? How about acknowledgement and recognition? How about just some faith? Some faith. Isn't that what the Lord requires of us? If we just would have faith, if we would just believe in him, wouldn't everything else just fall into place? Rather than exalting ourselves to that higher place. When we get down to verses 18 through to 27, this whole matter of marriage comes up, doesn't it? The whole matter of marriage. A bit of faith. Need faith, don't you? Good faith to keep a relationship going. But the relationship you can have with God through faith is not just a relationship that will keep you going for a few years in this world. Faith is a relationship with God that, if you will believe in him, will keep you going in this world and in the world to come. The Apostle Paul, when he's talking about this life compared to the life that is to come, compares this life to a seed and the life to come to the plant that grows from it. So take an acorn and an oak tree. He says this life is like an acorn. It's something that gets sowed and invested, eventually falls into the ground and dies. But something comes from it that is so much more glorious, so much more magnificent than anything that you've seen here. And faith connects you to God, not just in this world, but in the world to come. A covenant that binds you into a loving relationship with God, not just in this world, but in the world to come. And the truth is that marriage, which is, you know, the most profound personal relationship that you can enter into in this world, is by comparison pretty temporal and passing. You weren't born married. And if you don't invest, if you're not faithful to each other and you don't invest in that marriage, you may not stay married. And eventually, even if you have a wonderful marriage, Ron, Mark, 50 years of marriage, wonderful marriage, eventually, one of the things we admit when we get married is, until death do us part, it doesn't last forever. And we will see each other again. That's what Jesus is talking about at the resurrection. We will see each other again. We will see each other not as my husband or my wife. We'll see each other, he says, like the angels, as the servants of God, uniquely related to God, who you are. All other covenants, all other commitments, everything else dissolves. That's why you have to put God first. Because it is the one true, final, binding, and lasting covenant necessary for us all, in which everything else has to find its place, because everything else is passing. But God remains. And so in this world, you know, when we're choosing, you know, getting involved in a marriage, I mean, God forbid, if you've got yourself into a relationship and it's not a happy marriage or whatever, it's a, you know, there is a sense in which it could end. And it will end. But if you get your relationship with God wrong, you'll live with the consequences of that forever. Forever. So it's really important to get your relationship with God right. Because it's not just this life, it's the life to come. It's not the club, going to church and coming and going and all the rest of it. It's like an acorn that's comparatively insignificant compared to the long-term, eternal consequences of your relationship with God here and now. This is the shallows. And these people have got it so wrong, haven't they? They think it's all about this life, all about this world, working it all out in this world. They are absolutely so wrong about that, aren't they? And they didn't like hearing it. They didn't like hearing it because, you know, people put so much investment, so much faith into this world and what happens in this world and their status and their position and all the things of this world. What would it honestly do you? What kind of good would it do if you've got, what? I don't know what this world has to offer, but let's say you got the lot. You've got the Maserati. You've got, I don't know what you're after. I don't know what you want, but let's say you get the lot and then you lose your soul. That was a big mistake. That was a big mistake. They didn't like hearing that. But, you know, the sooner we get used to it, the sooner we get used to the truth and the reality and the facts, but you know, it will change your life. It will change your life. I gladly confess, right? Before I was converted, it was just after the miners' strike. Do you remember the miners' strike? Margaret Thatcher and the miners' strike. I'm going to be open about my earlier politics. I was not a fan of Margaret Thatcher. I thought she would have been brutal, brutal with the miners. And when I read as a new Christian that we were to pray for our leaders, I nearly fell out of love with the Christian faith. Okay? But I realized that I had to pray for my leaders. Every single soul, whatever we do in this world, the eternal things are so much weightier. I wouldn't want anybody to end up in hell, not one, not even the people who won't turn off their phones during the sermon, you know. We should pray. We should offer each other enough love and compassion. I don't matter what you've done or where you've been or we should at least pray for each other. It changes your life. It changes your whole sense of attitude, doesn't it? I was a bit of a tearaway. I was a bit of a tearaway at school. I'll be honest with you, and I can talk about this freely. I can put it on tape. We, my friends, we used to break into the local cricket club. And don't get any ideas here. Break into the local cricket club with, you know, R. White's lemonade bottles, empty lemonade bottles, which we used to nick from the local, outside the back of the local shop. We used to go in the middle of the night to the cricket club. We used to break in through a window, and there was all the taps, the bar taps. We used to fill up those lemonade bottles with beer, and we'd walk out of that place in the middle of the night. We'd pass them out the window. We might go away with 30, 40 litres of beer, stick them back in the crates, go up the golf club, 3 o'clock in the morning, me and our friends, we'd have a great time. And once we got away with it once, we did it again and again and again. It was our little number. When I became a Christian, I went down to the local police station, because by that point, you can understand, I had a bit of a complex about the police. I went down to the local police station. I said, "My name is Ben Midgley. This is what I've done. You, as far as I know, I don't know whether there's any record of this unsolved crime or you want to bring charges, but here I am." And they put me in the local cell, and I sat in there with some guy who'd been drinking too much. I talked to him about Jesus for about an hour, and then I got put out in front of the duty sergeant, who says, "Well, we've got no records of it. I think you better get on your way. Thanks for coming clean." And after that, I don't look at the police like I used to look. They're doing a job, and thank God for it. Good police officers are a precious thing, aren't they? Just find your place. I needed to find my place. I was getting out of hand. I wasn't respecting the boundaries. Jesus helped me find my place in this world. It's so important. And he'll help you. And I'm sure he has helped you already. These people so needed it. And we see in 28 verse 34, chapter 12 verse 38, somebody's been listening to all the people arguing with Jesus and fighting Jesus and resisting Jesus. I remember those times when everybody's basically out there. The world I was growing up amongst, people had no time for Jesus. They thought he was ridiculous. God didn't exist. Religion was the source of all evil. And he's listening to, I remember listening to everybody arguing about God and arguing about religion and dismissive and all the rest of it. And I remember my heart starting to change. I remember thinking, as I listened to what Jesus had to say, and thinking about what Jesus has done and who he is, and finding in the arguments that I'd start standing up for him and speaking out for him. I was thinking, did I just say that? What's going on? I started to realize that I was getting drawn to this person, Jesus. And that's what we see here in chapter 12, isn't it? This teacher of the law in verse 28, he's been amongst all the disputers and the whole culture of antipathy towards God and towards Christ. But he's starting to listen. He's starting to realize this Jesus has got something. This Jesus is someone. And actually, you know, I think he might be right. I think maybe it's me that's been the problem. Maybe it's me that's been wrong. Maybe it's me that needs to change. And his heart starts to change, doesn't it? His heart starts to get warmed. He's no longer fighting. He's listening to Jesus. And now when he listens, he's open. And Jesus says to him, you know, the kingdom of God is not far. You're nearly there. Why? Simply because faith is coming. Faith. Once you've got faith, you've got that covenant, that relationship with God that will last forever. And it's starting in his heart. It's so exciting when you see people being drawn to the Lord, strangers from him, in a culture that's hostile to him, and yet gradually, by the grace of God, they're being drawn to him. Their eyes are opening, their ears are opening, their hearts are understanding, and they begin to believe. We're talking about having a baptism service. It's so exciting when you see somebody, they start to hear about Jesus, and their hearts change, and they say, yes, yes, I believe in Jesus. I welcome him as my king. I'm ready to do his bidding. And the first thing he says is, believe and be baptized. Show it. Show it. So exciting, isn't it? When you see good parenting going on, good parent, consistent laying on of boundaries, doesn't it give those who are being parented such peace, such security? They know where they stand. Once they submit to that and they recognize that. Who's seen The Strictest Parents in the World? Does anybody see that TV program? Yeah, you've seen it. It's almost, the pattern is absolutely amazing how it happens. It doesn't matter where they send the kids, what part of the world they send them to. If the parents are consistent, loving boundary keepers, the same thing happens. The kid turns up, they're an absolute nightmare. They're trying to deceive, trick, get around every single, exploit every single loophole. The parents just stand their ground. They give them chores. They get them up in the morning. They get them to work. They complain. They accuse. They get nasty. They get unpleasant. And then eventually, probably about Wednesday of the first week, they burst into tears. They burst into tears. And they miss their mum, who they've been treating like dirt back home. And they miss their dad, who they just won't respect or listen to at all. And they wish they were home. And the parents just reach out to them and comfort them and say, don't worry, it's just a few more days, it's going to be fine. And by the end of that week, they're getting up, they're doing their jobs, they're loving it. And when they go home, they don't want to go home. They are so bonded with these two that they just feel themselves to be so secure. And they go home and they knock on the door, Mum, I've missed you so much, I'm going to make some changes. I'm going to be helping out more at home. It's an amazing thing to watch. And it's great to see people just submitting to Jesus and coming to that tearful place. I can't go on anymore. You hold all the cards. You are Lord. I'm not. And I want to walk in your ways. And you know, he gives you a whole new life. And it's better than the life you had. It's the better than the life you have. He starts to like what he hears. And as we see Jesus then opening up, all the questions finish, don't they? It says in verse 35, nobody wants to ask, 34, nobody wants to ask him any more questions anymore. Something's changed. And from that point onwards, Jesus then just begins to open up and to teach and revealing. It's such a lovely thing, isn't it? When you start submitting to Jesus, you start looking in the Bible and you suddenly realize, yeah, Jesus is Lord. It's all the way through the Bible. It's on every page. I can see it now. And it says those people who were listening as Jesus was teaching, they were delighted. You see that in verse 37. Suddenly, coming to church, spending time in the Bible, praying, it's just a joy and a delight. It's Jesus, isn't it? Of course it's Jesus. Praise him. Praise him. It's the Lord. And such peace comes into your life. Such a change comes over your life. And you suddenly realize that all those people have been telling you and teaching you and showing you that it's not so, that it's a different way, have either just been ignorant or malicious or selfish or something. They've just been keeping, why have they been keeping these, just the simple good truth from you? It's all exposed, isn't it? It's all exposed. And those people who've been teaching that Jesus is not Lord, as he begins to round on the scribes and the Pharisees, you know, there's a price to be paid for misleading people, for misdirecting people. It's a great responsibility, isn't it, to lead people aright, to teach people aright, to point people in the right direction. I wonder, they must have been very nostalgic about King David and the days of David and the glory years. But if they'd lived in David's Jerusalem, they would have had to keep his laws, wouldn't they? He was the king. They'd have to keep his laws. How much more, when the Christ has come, when Jesus has arrived, should we keep his commandments? He's the king. Jesus is Lord, isn't he? I love the fact that I've seen people get caught, you know, like speeding tickets or somebody drink driving. Think it'll be all right, I won't get caught. But you know, the police are really quite observant these days, and drink driving, it's not just the police. All sorts of people really don't like drink driving. You sit in a pub and you drink a bottle of wine and you get out, you get in the car, you'll probably find one of the other people in the pub will phone the police and let them know about it. Because people really hate drink driving. They've seen the misery that it causes. And I've seen somebody do this. They've got drunk, somebody's ticked them off, somebody's phoned the police, they've stepped into the car, the police has been right there and nabbed them there and then. They've got 100 yards up the road. And in the end, it's like a little incident happening out of the way, in the middle of nowhere, who cares, a little matter, sort of thing. And the lawyer has advised this person, fight, don't admit your guilt, just hold your ground, and so on and so forth. I remember talking to this person saying, whatever you do, just admit that you've done wrong and say sorry. Come clean. Accept whatever is your dues. Face it. You have done wrong. Admit it. Confess it. But he listened to the lawyer. And he went to that court and he stood there and he was facing a shield on the wall. And that great big shield with all its crests and all this stuff says, Due et mon droit. Right? That's probably very bad pronunciation. But it's, I think it's Latin, and it means God is my right. And it's the Queen's own personal shield. He was facing Her Majesty the Queen, her judiciary, her officials. He was standing before the throne saying, I'm okay, I haven't done anything wrong. That judge threw the book at him. He lost his license for 18 months. He nearly lost his job. It nearly broke his family. When you face the king, just own up. Own up. Confess your sins. He'll be good and just to forgive you. He's a good God. He's a good God. Why do people just keep on fighting? Why do people just keep on fighting? Finally, we've been talking about faith, haven't we? And everybody has faith. Everybody has faith. And you invest it in different things, don't you? Invest it in something. We're all investing our faith into something. The real question is whether we're investing it in something that is worthy, something that can actually is worth pouring your little lives into. And the truth is here that we see this little widow lady, and she's just pouring her faith into something. A lot of people, all these people around, they're not really pouring everything in, are they? They've got lots and they're just giving a little. They're keeping themselves to themselves. They're running their own shows. They're too canny and wise. But, I mean, they're basically believing in themselves, their own self-preservation. And this little lady, though, she believes in God, and she's pouring out her heart. She's pouring out her life, investing it in. And yet, what's so sad is that she's pouring everything in. You think that people who've got that faith and willing to give up their faith, they deserve to be able to invest that faith into something that will treasure what they're offering. That if you give your heart, you'll be able to give your heart to someone or to something that will appreciate the value of what you're giving. You know, and as she's giving and giving and giving and giving, the people are just taking it and taking it all and using it for themselves. She is being ripped off left, right, and center. And sadly, so many people are investing their lives, they're investing their time, they're investing their talents and their faith into things that are valueless, don't appreciate you, don't love you, in the end, cannot save you, cannot deliver you. They may be able to help you for a while, but in terms of time and eternity, they're absolutely powerless. The priests and all these people in the temple, they couldn't help. They weren't going to help. In fact, all they were going to do is add more rules and regulations and just run your life for you. And Jesus watches that little lady investing the misery of this little lady, investing herself into what is essentially false religion that will get her nowhere. And he's ready to act and stand in and present himself. And even though it's going to cause him to suffer and die, that the backlash from what he's doing, they will kill Jesus. But he's prepared to do that, so she has got somebody who will stand up, who she can believe in, who will never let her down, who will always love her, who will always value and appreciate who she is and what she's doing. And her faith will not be wasted. won't just help her in this world, it'll help her in the world to come, world without end, when some of these big shots are weeping and wailing and gnashing their teeth and saying, I wish, I wish, I wish. That's our Jesus. That's our Jesus. Can you trust Jesus? Can you trust him? Is he trustworthy? Does he do what he says he will do? Does he give it all? Is there some sin in him? Some accusation you could bring? Some shortfall, inadequacy? Something with which we could accuse him? Jesus is Lord. Believe in him. Believe in him.